Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Welcome, everyone, to our pre-renovation live stream here at the Council of Trent Studios. Glad you all can join me. This is my second time doing a live stream. So Zach is in our video department at Catholic Answers, and I've been working with the video department to grow the Council of Trent podcast. It's hard when all of them are in San Diego and I'm here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. But Zach is being flown out today. In fact, his flight lands, I think, in about 20 minutes. And then he's going to come over here. I was hoping he'd be here earlier to kind of pop his head into the live stream. But he'll probably, by the time he gets here, we'll probably be done with the stream. And then we're going to tear this place up. I mean, not really tear it up. You know, I rent this office. By the way, for people who don't know, this is not a part of my house, which is nice because I've done this before out of our master bedroom closet. The kids come in. It clearly looks like a closet. It's still a nice space, though. But no, I've been able to rent an office not too far from my home, and it's working out well. But it's, you know, it's a typical office building. But I'm excited that they've got the Zach's going to come. We're going to decorate, new lighting. Super excited by all of that. So let's see here. Sound is good. Do more live streams. You bet I can. All right, let's jump into the questions. I saw a few things on the internet I just wanted to talk about too. I guess I can do whatever I want. It's my live stream, but I'll jump into a few of these questions here. And then I want to talk. There were a few things I wanted to mention. Here's our first one from Hogan Donahue. I hope Cameron Bertuzzi is hard at work. He's got to work his way up in the Catholic apologetics world now. Hee hee. You know, I'm planning to see Cameron soon. He lives in Houston. I'm going to be going down to Houston. I'll be on Capturing Christianity, talking about atheism. May interview him for my channel. We'll see if we can work our schedules out for that. But this would be I think Keith Nestor gave some unsolicited advice to Cameron. This is my unsolicited advice to him, to Cameron. And I think Cameron already has taken this to heart, basically. I don't think he should do Catholic apologetics for a very, 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 very long time. I think that's fine. I'm a convert. I now do Catholic apologetics, but it takes many years to understand the church's teaching, to become familiar with it. It's definitely not something you should do immediately. Now, the thing I think Cameron should do apologetic-wise is he should do apologetics on mere Christianity, atheism, the resurrection, because Cameron's already been doing that for a long time. He's been doing that for years and years on Capturing Christianity. Now, he's in a great position. He should partner with Catholic channels and organizations to equip them to do the mere Christian apologetics. Because I'm going to be honest with you, there's not a lot of people in the Catholic world who really focus on that fundamental of the faith, on existence of God, natural theology. I mean, you got Ed Fazer and his blog. That's awesome. But when it comes to like channels, not a lot. And so we definitely could use more of that. And I love that Cameron be on the team to do that. But Catholic apologetics, I would say that's brand new territory. Don't jump into that as a convert. But if you've been already doing stuff for a long time, like mere Christian apologetics, have at it. So let's see. We got a few other comments here. We're just going to jump right into them. Let's see. Here's the next one from Jonathan. Have you seen the responses to your videos with Ruslan KD on his main channel and second channel, Bless God Studios, especially the most recent one about Mary? I've seen one of the responses. So I was recently interviewed by Ruslan KD. He is a Protestant YouTuber. He lives in San Diego, actually. So I sat down with him in his studio when I was visiting for the Catholic Answers conference. And so we chatted about Catholicism, had a great chat. I think it was very productive. But I've noticed that some people have made responses to the answers that I gave to Ruslan. And I may engage them in the future. I do think there's some things, you know, I could have added one detail here, one detail there. It's always hard when you are in an interview, you'll speak off the cuff. And so, you know, you won't necessarily say everything to qualify a particular answer. But I think I answered everything just fine to lay out a foundation for talking about Catholicism versus Protestantism. I saw one response, I think, dealing with what I said about indulgences. I haven't seen this one about Mary. Maybe in the future, maybe I'll string them together and do a reply video. I'm not sure. I'm really hoping in February, I'm planning to be back in San Diego to film a course for the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics. That'll be a course called Answering Protestant Objections. And while I'm there, I'm really hoping to sit down with Ruslan and John Steingard, who I because it's nice is when the people live in San Diego, it's like awesome. I can just have them come right over to a studio or sit down with them. So look for that in February. I think that's going to be a lot of fun. I'll do one more. Then I just want to talk about like one or two things I saw in the news and then lots of comments. Hopefully I'll try to get through as many as I can. I have to have this one. This comment is from Too Far with Laura Horn. This thumbnail made me laugh out loud. My question, when are you coming home? Oh, should I cut the live stream short? Come home, keep my wife company, help her make a video. Guys, you got to go check out Too Far with Laura Horn. It is legitimately funny. I'm not just saying that because I'm married to Laura. Like Laura is doing a ton of like, I mean, I'm telling you, that is what attracted me to Laura in the first place. So the first place is that she's super good looking. The second place was that she's super funny. And I think Laura would be fine with me saying that. But no, especially because she's funny and joyful. So you got to check out her channel, Too Far with Laura Horn. Want to see here, actually, can I see picture in picture layout? I'll just tell you about an article I saw on here. I need to show you the article. It was an article from NBC News about China. I just read it right before the live stream, and I'm just fuming. So it's on the White House. A White House spokesperson saying, you know, the protests going on in China because they're trying to do COVID zero policies. And so people are getting locked in their homes. It's always been a totalitarian state there, but even worse. So this is at NBC News, published 3 hours ago. White House issues a statement in support of peaceful protesters in China after demonstrations against the country's zero COVID policy. We long said everyone has the right to peacefully protest in the United States and around the world. White House National Security Council spokesperson said in a statement. That's bogus. This is absolutely bogus. Oh, we totally support the people in China protesting the zero COVID policy. Well, when people here were protesting the lockdowns and school closures, saying that they weren't working, and newer research has shown that it's very questionable if they did work at all to really effectively reduce mortality rates. When we were protesting here 2 years ago saying this policy, like here in Texas, thank you, Lord. In California, we protested the beaches being closed, protesting trails being closed. We were told, no, you don't have a right to protest. We were told you don't have the right to go out and murder people by breathing. That's what the government and bureaucrats told us back then, that when we were protesting lockdowns here, the government was basically emulating China, saying, well, China's doing these lockdowns, we better do them too. What a dumb idea. Just because China does something, here's what galls me about the article. At the end of the article, it says, the Chinese government argues its pandemic strategy has saved lives and is necessary to protect the fragile healthcare system. The latest deaths bring China's official toll to more than 5,000 compared to more than 1 million in the United States. End of the article. So we're going to take China's word for it that only 5,000 people have died of COVID there because of their lockdowns versus a million here. This is a staple in Western journalism to uncritically, they've done it since the Soviet Union, Cuba, to uncritically listen to whatever a communist or socialist regime says and to accept their statistics without question. It's galling to see stuff like that. Anywho, that was my political rant. Let's get back to some more questions here. it's a live stream. I can talk about whatever I want to talk about. This next question comes from Amy G. I have an Anabaptist cousin asked me for a book recommendation from pre-300 AD, open-minded when it comes to Catholicism. Any ideas? So the question can go in one of two ways. A book about the church before the year 300, which would be Constantine, or a book written before the year 300. So, I mean, that'll definitely narrow it if it's the latter one. If you're looking for something to write about, to read that was written prior to the year 300 about the church, sources I would recommend, I would start with the letters of the writings of St. Ignatius of Antioch. One of my most popular videos on the channel is the Church Father Protestants Fear the Most. And that is St. Ignatius of Antioch. Now, I'm not saying St. Ignatius proves the Catholic faith or something like that, but I've seen Protestants try to explain away St. Ignatius of Antioch, who died around the year 110, 106 AD, right at the beginning of the second century AD, trying to explain him away a lot more than other church fathers because he is so early and he forcefully argues for the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist, the need to follow the bishop, the role of the bishop, the monoepiscopacy. So very different from the Protestant views of the ancient church being a lot more decentralized, not necessarily under a bishop or things like that. So I think the letters of St. Ignatius of Antioch, if you want to read writings before Council of Nicaea, St. Ignatius of Antioch, Irenaeus Against Heresies, especially Book 3, Chapter 3, talks about the succession of bishops of Rome. So Against Heresies, Book 3, Chapter 3, Section 3 is a specific one on the successors of St. Peter. I think it's written after 300. The other one would be Eusebius Church History, but I'm pretty sure that was written after Nicaea, but still pretty close. So I'd probably go with Ignatius of Antioch. Didache is also a good one. If you want a book about the church prior to Nicaea, I would recommend The Early Church Was the Catholic Church by my friend and colleague, Joe Heschmeyer. So that's an excellent book on early church history. I am planning in a year or two to write a book on Protestant views of the church fathers and where they are distorted. So that will be, I cover the church fathers a bit in The Case for Catholicism, but I'm going to do a more in-depth exploration of that in a future book. That'll come out in a year or two because I got other books coming out. I'm hoping next month, January, February, second edition of Persuasive Pro-Life will be out. And we will have my book, When Protestants Argue Like Atheists. I'm finishing the final edits on that now, back and forth with Todd, the editor of Catholic Answers Press. So that's I'm really excited about that book, When Protestants Argue Like Atheists. Also, in every chapter, we're including a section, When Catholics Argue Like Atheists. So not just picking on Protestants. I want to help purify the dialogue between Catholics and Protestants on both sides. CNN, popular Catholic apologist is pro-slavery, experts say. Not sure what that's about, but if it's CNN, I definitely don't trust what that is. Something they would say. I actually clicked on this comment from Charlie because it reminds me of, I spoke at Boston College recently on pro-life, and the Boston College newspaper reported on my talk. And the headline for the article, so when I was arguing at Boston College, like the headline was Trenhorn compares abortion to slavery. Like that's what you're going to run with, which is very misleading, because then when you read in it, what was the comparison I was making? I was not comparing the act of abortion to the act of slavery. What they quoted was a part of my presentation where I said that some people defend abortion by saying, yes, this is a baby. Yes, this is a human being. I don't care. I can do what I want. And I said, what is it called when you treat one human being any way you want to? That's like that sounds like slavery to me. So I was not comparing the act of abortion to the act of slavery. I was comparing that particular rationale for abortion, I don't care if it's a baby, I can do what I want, to the rationale for slavery, which is, I don't care if this is a human being, I can do what I want. And the parallel there is absolutely perfect. So we have to be careful, like when we compare abortion, when you talk about similarities between the abortion and the Holocaust or abortion and slavery, it's not a one-to-one comparison. Most unborn children, for example, are not consciously aware of being aborted, whereas basically all people victims of the Holocaust and slavery, nearly all of them, are consciously aware of their sufferings. That's a difference. It doesn't make one good and the other bad, or one wrong and the other not wrong, but they're different. But people, there can be suffering in different ways. There can be acts of wrongdoing that cause different harms, but they're all gravely morally wrong. That was the point I was making when someone asked me about that. What philosophy, religion, or topic would you like to debate that you have not yet? As a former Mormon, I wish they would produce some debaters to engage other religions, but they don't really. You know what? I would actually enjoy debating a Mormon. There is a Mormon apologist whose work that I follow. His name is Robert Boylan, I think is his name. So I follow his work. I follow some of the people at Fair Mormon. Blake Osler, I think, is another. Mormons is funny. They don't really stress apologetics a lot. They really focus on the witness of the Holy Spirit. But they got a few people who really do their research, philosophy and theology wise. So I'd be interested in debating specific Mormon doctrines with them, like the doctrine of eternal progression, of men becoming gods, how many gods are there? So, you know, classical Christianity and classical theism is monotheistic. There's only one God. Mormonism is henotheistic, or they practice what's called monolatry, which is that there is one God that deserves to be worshipped, but he exists alongside many other gods. Mormonism would be one. Islam. I did a rebuttal not too long ago to Sheikh Uthman, who is a Muslim apologist who lives in San Diego. I think I put out a call to see if you want to do a debate on whether Islam is true. And we could do that in San Diego. That'd be great. We got a great facility there. The church usually hosts these things, and he's local. So maybe I'll try to set that one up. But I got my hands full. I got a debate on atheism in February and against a philosophy professor, I think, in Ohio. And, of course, Sola Scriptura with Gavin Ortland in March on Pints with Aquinas. So do go and check that out. Excuse me. Why don't you smoke a pipe like Jimmy Akin? Look at me. I'm coughing as it is. I think everyone's kind of sick right now, honestly. I feel like I'm always on the precipice. At night, when I think I'm about to get sick, I gargle warm salt water, and I try to drink as much orange juice as possible. Maybe it's a placebo. I don't know. But it seems to help. I'm usually able to kick it, usually in like an hour or two. But I never got into smoking, really. I guess I'm just not regal enough or hip enough to do that. But I never got into smoking. And you know what? I probably never will. Never got into smoking. Never got into drinking. I would have made a great Mormon, I guess. But I like soda, so I guess I probably can't do that. So I never got into it. And now that I am training more, doing like kickboxing and jujitsu, I am focusing now on stamina, cardio. I mean, I'm 37 years old. That's old in jujitsu world, basically. I'll be rolling with 20-year-olds who are high school wrestlers, and I get just flattened because they're fast, they're agile, and they're strong. But I try to use my old man dad strength to try to keep up with everybody. So what's hard with jujitsu, my wife would be like, don't talk about jujitsu. I'm going to say, come on, just a little bit. So I'm not super strong. I don't know the technique yet. All I can do is, a guy said today, one thing you have going for you is you're very squirrely. I'm like, thank you. If I'm pinned, I can kind of weasel my way out and get back into a different position. So I'm not going to take up smoking, just because I got to have my lungs running at 100% maximum capacity. Trent, I just found out I'm going to be a dad. I'm a nervous wreck. What should I know? Also, your prayers are appreciated. Oh, let's say a prayer for Matt. Lord, please help Matt as to be a good father and to help his child to be born in a safe, healthy way. Matt, you know, I'm just going to tell you this. It's okay to be nervous. But here's what's nice. You got time to figure things out. You know, you get overwhelmed thinking being a dad, like, how am I going to teach my son this? How am I going to do that? Here's what's great. When they're born, they eat, sleep, and poop. You'll figure out diapers pretty fast. Laura will attest that I am really good at getting out of diaper duty. I'm so awful at that. I always find a way to get out of changing diapers. I think I've changed like 4 in the history of our entire marriage. Purgatory is just going to be me changing diapers for like 10,000 years, I think. So I always tell her, I get weirded out. I don't like changing a newborn's diaper because, like, a newborn, they're like a little alien. Like, they don't have like a butt because they're so little, and it freaks me out. I'm like, I can't do it. And I just have to go hide in another room. So I can't do it when the baby is too little. And if they're too big and they got all the fat rolls and the poopies, sorry if anyone was eating their lunch, I can't do that either. So it has to be very sweet spot for like 3 weeks of their life. I can change their diaper. So I'm terrible. But here's the thing, Matt, look, you will pick it up. You're going to make mistakes. All I can say to you is you're a better father than you know. And the fact that you care about being a good father shows you're a good father. The fact that you're nervous that you won't be good shows that you are good. Because if you were a bad father, you wouldn't give a rip. Who cares? Damn kids. Leave me alone already. The fact that you're worried that you're not going to be good enough shows you are good enough. And you're never going to be good enough. We're always learning. I make mistakes with my kids all the time. The point is, just learn to be, say you're sorry to your wife, say you're sorry to your kids, and learn from mistakes. and you will get better and better as a father. And lead by example. Just focus on being a joyful Catholic, and your kids will see that. So dad advice from someone just trying to figure it out himself. Apple Seeds says, hello from Kenya. Hello. What time is it? See, Kenya local time is 10:22 at night. You stayed up late for the live stream. Well, I'm glad that it was it worked for you. Let's see here. Next one is Mortal Kombati. Hi, more and more Protestants are Nestorians, denying Theotokos and denying that God died on the cross. What do you think about that? Yeah, I definitely find that concerning. Do I have it here? Oh, I dropped my glasses. I had the book by Eric Svensson. I was thinking about doing a live stream on this. I think it's just out of reach. If I could use my force powers. Evangelical Answers, Eric Svensson. I haven't heard from him in a long time, but he used to be really big back in the early 2000s. Yeah, I've noticed some Protestant apologists. Now, some Protestants will say, yeah, Mary's the mother of God, but that title is about Jesus. It's not about Mary in any way. It's not about her being venerated. It's not bestowing honor on her. And that's not what you read Cyril at the Council of Ephesus. You can see that's plainly false. The title Theotokos is used to venerate Mary, to bestow an honor upon her, that she is the God bearer. But you have Protestants who don't want to use the title Mother of God. They end up falling into Nestorianism because they'll say Mary's not the mother of God. She's the mother of Jesus's body, to which then I want to say, OK, where is the son? Where is the second person of the Trinity? If Jesus's body is being born, where is the second person of the Trinity? If he's identical to the person being born, well, then you have two persons in one body. That's a problem. You have one person. OK. You know, and if he's not there, if he's somewhere else, if that human being, that human person becomes divine later, that's the whole problem with the Nestorian heresy. You split Christ into two persons when Christ is one person with a fully human nature and a fully divine nature. That one Catholic girl has a comment here. While in Vegas, I was thrifting and I found your book, Answering Atheism. To my surprise, it was a copy that you had signed. I actually found out about you because I thrifted Why We're Catholic randomly one day. Well, on the one hand, I am grateful if my books can get out to people. If it ends up in a thrift store, hey, this is, you know, if it reaches more people, that makes me happy. On the other hand, it's kind of funny, like autographed copy. Who needs this junk? You know, get rid of that, send it off to the thrift store. But I understand I'm having a post-workout moment, I guess. Maybe I always think working out keeps my brain sharp, but children drain it more, so there's more of a net loss. Now train jumped the tracks, it derailed. Let's move on. Let's see here. Callum S. I've been watching your wife's YouTube channel. The Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu video was hilarious. Alex is a girl was perfect. Yeah, go check out Laura's channel. You know what's funny with Laura's channel, by the way? So it started, Laura wanted to do a podcast. And I'll let her tell the story more. She wanted to respond to someone that she felt said things that were scandalous towards male podcasters in particular. So she wanted to do a reply. And so she set up the camera. And then she told me, never mind, podcasts are really hard. I don't want to do that. So I'm going to do short videos where I talk about things. And then it turned into, I want to do a short video that's funny where I impersonate someone. And now it's become that. But and it was fun to do the jiu-jitsu video. And I think it's, Laura is very, very cool about all of that. I'm the one who's being, obsessed by wanting to go all the time. It does turn into an obsession. I think people who do jiu-jitsu will know that. Pronounced Ruslan. Thank you. I am the worst. It's not Ruslan KD. It's Ruslan KD. So you can check out his channel. I'm on there a bit. This is from a wonderful individual who is Korean, whose name I cannot pronounce because it is in Korean. But I love Korean culture. There is a Korean grocery store. It's like a big shopping mart here. It's like the shopping mart of the future. And my family has been there. I have not yet, but I hear it is wonderful and delightful. I have not had a chance to go, but I find all of it to be just fascinating, excellent. He says, hi, Trent, I am Korean, and I loved your book, Why We're Catholic. I was wondering if you ever thought about publishing the book in foreign countries. God bless you. Thanks. Yeah, why of all the books I've written, Why We're Catholic is the one I want to get out there the most, so I'd happily publish it in foreign countries. The problem is it becomes very expensive for us to publish a book here in the United States. Even if, let's say we translate a book into Korean, and we print a bunch of copies here in the U.S., to ship them all the way to South Korea, you know, definitely they're not going to end up in North Korea unless we slide them under the barbed wire fence at the demilitarized zone, the DMZ. If we do that, it makes the book so expensive, nobody will buy them. Our best bet, we have discovered, is we want the book to get to an international market. We license the text to a foreign publisher. We've done this with Why We're Catholic. We've made a Spanish translation of it, ¿Por qué somos católicos? Now, what's ironic there is, I don't know if you read it, if you speak Spanish, get a copy of ¿Por qué somos católicos? Let me know what you think. The company that translated it is located in Spain, or as we learned in Spanish 1, España. Voy a la España. I go to Spain. So the Spanish that is spoken in Spain has a different dialect to it than, let's say, Spanish that's spoken in Mexico or in Nicaragua or, you know, in other places like that. So it might sound a little more European-y, kind of like how British English is different than American English, especially if you're in a part of Spain by Barcelona where they speak Castilian, that accent, Castilian in Barcelona. I have a little bit of a lisp. So yeah, hopefully if anyone knows a Korean Catholic publisher that wants Why We're Catholic, gladly work with them, license the text. So we would receive a portion of it, and they would basically print the book in South Korea, sell it. We'd be happy to do that. Hey, Trent, you should cut your hair. You, Fernando, you are absolutely right. Hey, let's go back to Matt. Hey, Matt, you're wondering about being a good dad. Just learn to accept you don't have a ton of time. Before you're married, you got all this time. After you're married, you still have a lot of time. When you have kids, time is that precious resource that floats away. And then, like, when I'm done, like, you know, let's say I'm up at night and I've gotten everything finished. There's no hair salons usually open at 9 o'clock at night, 10 o'clock at night. If they are, I don't know if I necessarily want to go. let's see, Laura, but really. Too far with Laura Horn. Oh, I'll be home at some point tonight, I'm sure. Let's see here. It's comment from Joe Ward. I'm a recent convert from Calvinism. Could you please help me to understand the Catholic view of the atonement? I grew up with penal substitution. I want to be able to explain the Catholic view. Well, there isn't a specific Catholic view of the atonement, except for the idea that Christ's death on the cross secures our salvation, that it merits the grace necessary for us to receive eternal life. So that's what we believe. That's what the church teaches about the atonement. But the church has not endorsed a particular theory of the atonement. Theologians are free to present different theories about how Christ specifically merits this grace for us through his death on the cross. But the church has taught there are particular views of the atonement that a Catholic cannot accept. So I want to say this paragraph 404. It's paragraph 603. 404 is on original sin. 603 is on the atonement. So it says here in paragraph 603 of the Catechism, Jesus did not experience reprobation, punishment, as if he himself had sinned. But in the redeeming love that always united him to the Father, he assumed us in the state of our waywardness of sin to the point that he could say in our name from the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? Having thus established him in solidarity with us sinners, God did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all so that we might be reconciled to God by the death of his son. So we have a general understanding here that Christ, in assuming human nature, Christ is able to stand for us, and then through his death, he is able to reconcile us to God. But it's very important, the first line here in paragraph 603, Jesus did not experience reprobation as if he himself had sinned. So the most popular theories of penal substitution say that when Christ was on the cross, he took our sins upon him. He literally became a sinner, which he couldn't literally become a sinner, right? That would violate his divine impeccability. If Jesus sins, he's not God. He is a divine person. So that means it is logically impossible, metaphysically impossible, I guess you would say, for Christ to sin, because God cannot sin. It's just impossible for God to do that. He's all holy. So Christ, he can't literally become a sinner. You have Christadelphians. They're kind of a quasi-Christian group. You might consider them Protestants. I don't know if they have a valid baptism, but they talk about Christ having a sin nature, for example. Most Protestants won't go that far, but they will say that Christ took on our sins. He became a sinner, but not literally so. And then we receive Christ's righteousness, called the Great Exchange. And so Christ takes our sins, and then God pours out his wrath upon Jesus on the cross. And so there, God punishes essentially an innocent person in our place. And so the church teaches that that is a view one cannot hold. Jesus was not punished as if he were a sinner. Now, you can say that Christ died for us, Christ was crucified for us. What that means is that Christ underwent a punishment so that we do not have to. But it does not mean that the Father did not hate Jesus and pour his wrath out on Jesus. He was not punishing Jesus. However, Jesus did receive punishing treatment. He suffered so we did not have to, but he was not punished as if he were a sinner. So that would be to say that, you can't hold penal substitution. I think that one of the most popular Catholic views of the atonement goes back to St. Anselm of Canterbury in the 12th century. Anselm's view is called the satisfaction view. And this is one I like to share of just helping people wrap their heads around atonement. The idea is that penal substitution is that God pours out his wrath on Jesus, and that is what takes away our sins. Rather, it is not God punishing Jesus takes away sins. It is that when Christ is crucified on the cross, the love that Christ has for humanity goes up from the cross to the Father, that it is a sacrifice of love that has infinite value because Jesus is God. So it has infinite value. It's applied on our behalf because Christ represents us. He has a human nature. So imagine a scale, and one side has the weight of our sins. It will be a lot. It will be hefty, but it will be finite. There's only a finite number of human beings. All right, so it's finite. Christ's death on the cross is infinite in value. It's supererogatory. It cancels out. So what I would say there, Christ's death on the cross was not, when Protestants say, do you believe that Christ's death on the cross was sufficient to take away sin? I will say it was far more than sufficient. It was super abundant. Christ's death on the cross was of infinite value. It was a more value, more graces merited than would ever be necessary to take away all the sins of the entire world. That's why you have, for example, 1 John 2:2. I'll read that to you. John is writing, 1 John chapter 2, my little children, I am writing this to you, and little children, talking about children in the faith, not literal children. So when he talks about fathers and children, by the way, John is referencing there are spiritual fathers, the presbyters, the priests, and the children are the laity. My little children, I'm writing this to you so that you may not sin. But if anyone does sin, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ, the righteous. And he is the expiation for our sins, and not for ours only, but also for the sins of the whole world. So Calvinists, five-point Calvinists, those who believe in limited or what they might call particular atonement, the idea that Christ only died to merit grace for those who would go to heaven. He did not die for anyone who is damned. What they would say is this verse means Christ died. He is expiation for our sins, not for ours only, but for the sins of the whole world. The most common Calvinist response to that verse is, well, what John is saying is that he died not just for the people John was writing to, but for Christians throughout the whole world. I find that very implausible. Cosmos, world, in the writings of John, refers to the entire world. When John talks about how the world is under the power of the evil one, he's not talking about just Christians, he's talking about everybody. So I find that very implausible in that respect. Tran, have you struggled with the silence of God? Yeah, I mean, I've made this very public for a long time that my spiritual life is not as vibrant as others, or people might feel like a deep presence of God. I have felt that in particular cases. When I went to Israel and was at the Church of Holy Sepulchre, I felt it, you know, of all places where you're going to feel it. Moments in prayer, very important in my life, I felt it, but day to day, not as much. But I think that's natural. Like, I'm married to my wife, but I don't like feel this overwhelming sense of joy. And like, I just have to curl up into a ball and smile because I'm so happy I'm married. I'm sure my wife would say, you do that every day, every hour of every day. I'm sure she does. But you know, or, you know, relationship with your parents or with friends, you know, those big senses of it, it's more something that is part of your reliable background knowledge that gives you comfort. But the silence of God, like, I feel like I have a strong intellectual assent about the existence of God and how God has revealed himself. And in prayer, I do feel that. But oftentimes when I pray, yeah, I don't sometimes get as much of a response, or I'm asked discerning something. I don't feel like God telling me. But I think a lot of times when we discern things, God doesn't tell us what to do because we have a lot of options we can pick from that he's totally okay with. So I would just not, if you struggle with that, let God know you struggle with it. And don't allow that to lead you to the conclusion you don't have a relationship with God just because you don't feel like you do. Because a lot of times we can have a relationship with someone and not even know it. There's philosophers of religion, epistemologists, they call this the doxastic quality of belief. About people could be in relationship with God and not actually know it because God is sustaining them, God is leading them, he's helping them grow in virtue, in joy, in humility. So that's something to check out in that respect. Do you find St. Anselm's ontological argument logical for proving the existence of a God, and why? No, I don't. I don't know any philosophers who find Anselm's argument persuasive. So the argument goes like this. God is that which no greater can be conceived. So if you can think of something greater, if you think of God, right? And let's say I think of God as a being who can do anything except levitate a pack of Kleenex. You know, is that God? Well, no, I can think of a being greater than that, a God who can do anything and make the Kleenex, you know, float in front of me. So Anselm's argument says, all right, well, I can imagine God in my mind. Why, you know, if I can imagine God in my mind, there is something greater than that, a God who actually exists. So if God is that being which no greater can be thought, then if God exists in the mind, I can think of something greater. It is a God who exists in reality. And so therefore God exists. The most common criticism of the argument is that existence is not a predicate. I think this was, Kant's objection to the ontological argument. That in order to ascribe a quality to something, you have to already establish that the thing exists. So you can't say, you know, God is the greatest being imaginable and also God exists. He either exists or he doesn't exist. And there's different ways people have tried to get around Anselm's argument that aren't as successful, like the parody argument. You know, is the greatest lion exist? Does the greatest island exist? And I don't think those parodies are super good, because they're incoherent concepts. There is no greatest island, because you could have an infinite number of palm trees and barbecue luau's and all that. There is no greatest basketball player, greatest line. You could always add attributes. God has maximal properties, like being all-knowing, all-powerful, necessarily existing, eternal. So you can't have a greatest being, even if you don't have a greatest lion or a greatest island. And this comes over into Plantinga's version of the ontological argument as well. But in general, though, I think that the way Anselm goes about it is not very successful. You know, he's probably done a lot of work on this. I think, well, Joe Schmidt at Majesty of Reason does a lot on ontological and cosmological arguments. So I'm sure he's spent like an hour ripping apart Anselm. But that would just be my impression. I don't find it to be that persuasive. A better one would be Plantinga's ontological argument, saying that it's possible a necessary being exists. If it's possible a necessary being exists in a possible world, but if he exists in one possible world, by definition, as a necessary being, he has to exist in every possible world. And if he exists in every possible world, he exists in the actual world. And planting his argument, it's a valid argument. Most philosophers who critique it, it's the first premise that they don't know if it's actually possible, metaphysically possible, that a necessary being exists. The problem with the argument, with planting his argument, is you can run a reverse ontological argument. If God is a necessary being, and that means in any possible world, he exists in that world. By the way, possible world is just a description of the way things could be. It doesn't mean they actually exist, unless you're a philosopher named David Lewis, who endorses modal realism that says all these possible worlds really do exist. But the point is, if God is a necessary being and he exists in every possible world, and he exists in the actual one, the idea is that, well, if it's possible God exists, he has to exist in one possible world. Okay, then that means if he's in one, then he's going to end up in all of them. But is it possible God does not exist? For a lot of people, they say, yeah, it's possible there is no God. But then by that logic, there is a possible world where God does not exist. And so therefore, God does not exist in every possible world. So there's no necessary being. You would need a symmetry breaker. I talked about this when I had Schmidt on the channel a while ago. So that one, you have to have a symmetry breaker to try to make Planting his argument work better. Planting, I even thought the ontological argument wasn't a great argument to show God exists. It's a good argument to show if you already believe in God, it strengthens your belief God exists. And I think that's valid. I think it is valid if you believe something is true and there's an argument that may not be persuasive to other people, may not be persuasive to others, but you already believe in God and it strengthens your belief and it has things make more sense, then I think that's completely justified. Sorry, let me talk to the mic. I'll give you an example. So I'm pretty soon on Pints with Jack. That is the C.S. Lewis podcast my friend David Bates is a part of. I am going to be on that podcast. I'm going to talk about the greatest critic of C.S. Lewis, the biggest critic of C.S. Lewis. That is a philosopher named John Beaver Sluice. All right. He wrote this book in 1985. It's called C.S. Lewis. I want to hold it so you can see it's in focus. It's called C.S. Lewis and the Search for Rational Religion by John Beaver Sluice. Actually, I bought this, I think, like 10 years ago on went through it a little bit back then. But I'm going to go on the show to talk about it. Beaver Sluice wrote this in 1985. He briefly corresponded with C.S. Lewis, actually. I'm not sure. I mean, Lewis died in 1963. So this would have, I mean, maybe it was like in the late 60s. I don't know when he wrote him. I can't remember. But it's probably the most comprehensive critique of C.S. Lewis I've seen out there. He wrote this in 1985. Then he did a second edition in 2007 that replies to people who defend Lewis, like Peter Kraft and Ronald Ticelli. In the first chapter of the book, Beaver Sluice goes after C.S. Lewis's argument from desire for the existence of God. The idea is that the argument from desire says that you don't have natural desires for things that don't exist. I don't have a natural desire to fly. I do have a natural desire to eat. I have a natural desire for the marital act, and those things really do exist. They may not always exist. I could be on a desert island and not have food, but there is such a thing as food. So you don't have natural desires for things that do not exist. There is a desire, though, for joy, for unsurpassed peace and fulfillment. That's a natural desire that is not satisfied in this life. Therefore, it must be satisfied in the next life. So it's not even an argument for God per se. It's an argument for heaven, for it coheres with belief in God. Now, if I was to go in a debate on the existence of God, it's not an argument I would run with. But in believing in God, I'd say, well, it kind of makes sense. Like, why do we have this desire? It doesn't seem to serve an evolutionary purpose. It would make sense if God gave us this desire. So I might do it inductively or abductively, inference to the best explanation. The best explanation for why I have this desire is that God gave me that desire. So that gives evidence that God exists. Once again, I'd use it to retrofit a more robust argument. I wouldn't necessarily lead with it. And what's hard is for a long time, I have thought that there are objections to this. Like, I've tried to think of natural desires that are not fulfilled. I'm going to save more discussion for that are incapable of being fulfilled, that don't have objects. I'll save that for when I talk about it on Bates's channel. But I've enjoyed reading through this other book by Joe Puckett Jr. called The Apologetics of Joy. Right here. And this is a book length defense of the argument from desire. So like I said, I don't think this argument is a good argument to prove God exists right out of the blue, but I think it can be part of a supporting case where, especially if you believe in God, it can further reinforce that belief. There's no harm in having more arguments at your disposal. Ah, Robert Boylan has joined the chat. Our favorite Mormon apologist out there. He gave a very nice, kind blurb, actually, to my book, The Case for Catholicism. He called it probably one of the best single-volume defenses of Catholicism he's come across. Yes, so Boylan is referencing a book. The other church, if you want to say if Catholicism is not, if you want to say that Catholicism is not historical, does not cohere with the early church, he's referencing William Webster's book, The Church of Rome at the Bar of History. Although, oh, maybe this is a pun from Robert, because he wrote William Webster at the Bar of History. I don't know what Boylan thinks about it. I think some of Webster's stuff, I mean, I've engaged it in Case for Catholicism. I don't find his arguments to be that persuasive in what he argues. Gavin Ortland has recommended The Church of Rome at the Bar of History. So if you want some replies to Webster, there's a lot of them on the internet. I think that book's been around since, let's say, 95. I got to keep my books closer to me. I wish I could just like throw a hook to like to get them. But I don't find it to be that persuasive of a book. I engage in Case for Catholicism. I will probably engage even more thoroughly along. I'm excited to do this book, by the way, on the Church Fathers from a Protestant perspective. Like, I think I'll call it the Protestant Church Fathers question mark. I don't know. But I'm excited. It'll probably come out in 2 or 3 years because I'm going to, in that book, I'm going to engage Jerry Walls. And who is the guy he wrote it with? So Jerry Walls, Roman but not Catholic, What Remains at Stake by Kenneth Collins and Jerry Walls. That book came out about the same time as Case for Catholicism. Cameron referenced it. He's referenced it on his YouTube channel. So it came out right after Case for Catholicism. So I wasn't able to engage it when I wrote Case for Catholicism back in 2017, which was another, you know, I also wanted to write that book on the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation or Revolution, as I might call it. So I'm excited to engage the Protestant Church Fathers in a lengthy treatment because I'll also engage some of Roman but not Catholic. And Gavin Ortland is publishing a book, The Case for Protestantism. So I'm excited to read that book and engage it. It might be similar to kind of the back and forths he and I have had on our respective YouTube channels. Let's jump from Protestant Catholic to bioethics. This is from Lauren Crawford. I have heard that the only acceptable way to treat an ectopic pregnancy is to remove the fallopian tube. Is this true? What are your thoughts? The church has not given a definitive teaching on of the commonly accepted methods for ending a tubal ectopic pregnancy. So that would be when an embryo implants in the fallopian tube and continues to grow, which is bad because the fallopian tube is not designed to sustain a pregnancy. If it continues to grow, it will burst. It could sever an artery. It could lead to internal bleeding and death. That's happened throughout history a lot. Now we have more modern medicine to resolve that that situation. But there's three recommended ways to deal with a tubal ectopic pregnancy. One would be salpingectomy. That would be the removal of a section of the fallopian tube. Another would be salpingostomy. I hope I'm not reversing these. I don't think I am. Goodness, I have a master's degree in bioethics. I better not be. Salpingostomy is when you make an incision on the fallopian tube and then remove the embryo, and it keeps the tube intact. The other method is methotrexate, which slows the cellular growth of the placenta, causing the embryo to detach and then be miscarried. The Magisterium has not weighed in on this question, so all three of those methods are open. Some moral theologians have argued that, for example, methotrexate is immoral or only salpingectomy is permitted. Those are the opinions of moral theologians. The Magisterium has not weighed in on the subject yet. I have not formally weighed in on. I'm just going to say what the church teaches, that the church allows those three. And so I like to give people liberty where the church gives people liberty in that regard. So most people are skeptical of methotrexate. They treat it as a direct attack on the child. Others who defend it say you're not attacking the child, you're attacking the placenta. Then the response is that's a distinction without a difference, really. But the church allows all three. Here's the thing. Solid Catholic thinkers that I know defend the permissibility of using methotrexate to end an ectopic pregnancy. Chris Cazor, who is the author of the book, The Ethics of Abortion, its third edition is now out. So definitely probably the best philosophical defense of the pro-life view I've ever come across. It's awesome. And so he's super duper pro-life. No question about his bona fides. And he says he justifies methotrexate intervention. Check out Chris Cazor, Ectopic Pregnancy Methotrexate. You can find his papers free to download online, and you can read that. So, Lauren, to answer your question, as of this moment, the church has not definitively, has not issued an answer to the question. It's an open question in moral theology. So you can use salpingectomy, salpingostomy, or methotrexate to resolve an ectopic pregnancy. Friendly Christian dialogue. Any advice for a new Christian Catholic apologetics channel on YouTube? Oh, this is kind of a little bit of a practical one here. I would love to see more Catholic apologists on YouTube and on social media. So if I was to give my advice, let me bracket it into different areas. First would be, I guess it could be spiritual, intellectual, practical. Spiritual is to remember, why are you doing this? If it's to crush people, if it's to become famous, if it's to enjoy people complimenting you, don't do it. You're in for crashing your ship on the rocky shores. And worst case scenario, as Paul says in 1 Timothy 1, you'll make a shipwreck of your faith. He talks about people who make shipwrecks of their faith, by being more into themselves than God, loving the creature more than the creator. So why are you doing this? So it's because, well, I want to build up the body of Christ. I want to serve people. That's great. But don't let it crowd out your spiritual life. Stay grounded. Have other people to help you. Have people to make sure that, you are not in a bad place. People that you will counsel you, who will look at your YouTube channel and say, hey, what you were saying lately, I don't think that's a good idea for you to go down that road. I have seen Catholic apologetic channels where the host becomes uncivil, mean, rude, ignorant, or arrogant. Both of those together is awful. At least a smart, arrogant person has their smartness going for them, but an ignorant, arrogant person is just the worst. And you need somebody close to you to be able to have a come to Jesus moment with you to say, hey, this isn't good what you're doing. So that's spiritual, communal. But if you want to then intellectual, like what content are you creating? Try to find what people want that would be really good for them, be really helpful for them. And I would say, look, you don't have to become an expert in everything. Don't worry about that. Honestly, what you might want to focus on, I guess it's a trade-off, right? If you become an expert in one particular thing and you post on that topic, people will go to you as the go-to expert. And that's great. And you can have content that's unique and really helpful. You're not going to have a wide reach, though. You're not going to get a ton of people. You're not going to get a million subscribers in a year if you are the channel about if you just only did indulgences, I think a lot of Catholics would subscribe to that. But if you just did one very particular thing, I defend the perpetual virginity of Mary on this channel. That's all we talk about. That's great. It's not going to be as widely known or as followed as a channel that just defends Catholicism or talks about Catholic life. Broader topics will get wider audiences, but it can be hard to do broad topics as an apologist. You have to know about a lot of different things. You got to be careful in that regard. So I'd recommend, if you want to do an apologetics channel, there's a few different ways you can go about it. You can create the content. And if you're going to do that, I would try to become an expert in a very particular area. So it's good. So that's one thing you can do. Another thing you can do is you can popularize content. You can say, hey, there's great stuff out there. I want to talk to you about this Catholic book and the arguments in it. And all you do is you take what's in, Apologetics of Joy by Joe Puckett. I read this book. It was really awesome. Here's his argument. You want more? Check out his book. And you don't pretend to be the master apologist. You're just saying, hey. And honestly, a lot of what I share with you guys is I read this in a book and it was really cool. And maybe here's some of my insights in some of these arguments. But you can just say, hey, look, I just read this stuff and I want to share it with people. And that's that. And you are popularizing, you are helping it be more accessible to people. If you can read academic works and do that, that's even better to make it accessible for people. Or you can interview people who know what they're talking about and make sure that your job is to pull out the nuggets of wisdom from them. But if you're going to do it, be consistent. Focus on good audio and tech, by the way. There's no excuse in this day and age. You can just spend $500 and honestly, focus on a good microphone before a good camera. People, audio is 60% of the quality, 60%. Get a good audio. You can get a good microphone for a few hundred dollars. You can get a soundboard. Can I get my soundboard over here without falling apart? Oh, let's see if it doesn't. See? All right. This is only, I think it's like $200. It's not that expensive. I only use one channel, but if I have a guest, I can plug their mic in. I could take a phone call and plug that channel in if I wanted to. If you're going to start a channel, you got to come up with $500 just to get a good microphone. Use your webcam. Webcams are actually pretty good right now. Get a good microphone and use headphones. Otherwise, people aren't going to listen a long time if it's echoey, and there's so much good quality out there, people aren't going to stick around. I guess that's going into practical now. So practical is just being consistent, getting good gear, put a light on yourself, and try to steal ideas from other people, what they do to make things look good. That's why Zach is coming here. But one last thing, resist the temptation to chase views. You might think, oh, what if I talked about this really controversial thing, or I ripped on this thing that, you know, Catholic, it's easy to stray into Catholic gossip or stray into things that get views and clicks. Don't do that. Always think, how is what I'm going to put out serving people? Now, I will focus on things that are popular. I'll talk about Matt Walsh was on Joe Rogan. Okay, let me talk about that and talk about how to defend marriage. It's serving people and focusing on something that people want to talk about. So if you can combine the two, you're doing good. You're doing well. Any good suggestions for books explaining theology of the body and sexual desire? I have an autistic brother who struggles with understanding his desires. Well, I know good books that would deal with sexual ethics in general. I still think Christopher West's book, The Good News About Sex and Marriage, is an excellent book for that. I would get the newest edition of it. We used it, and when I worked at the Diocese of Phoenix under Bishop Olmsted, we had a marriage prep program, and we used that book. I thought it was very accessible for people. So that's one I would start off with. I don't know if there's any others right off the bat about sexual desires. I know there's... Is it Favale that did Genesis of Gender? I don't know if she talks about sexual desire in that book. The Genesis of Gender, A Christian Theory by Abigail Favale. Is that how you pronounce it? I don't know. I'm committed, Father Mike would say. Laura parodies in her recent video. So that's the first one that comes off the top of my head. But I don't know if there's specific subjects dealing with autism or being on the autism spectrum and desires. I don't know that off the top of my head. Any hints on the design of the new studio? I think it'll have, we're not doing the bookshelves in the back. Every Catholic apologist has bookshelves behind him. We'll have shelves, we'll have fun stuff. I don't know. You try to steal from Cameron Bertuzzi and Matt Frad. I just wanted to make something nice. I just told them, hey, you know, whatever you guys think is best. I don't know exactly a ton about design. And are you worried about the failure of pro-life ballot measures this midterm? I mean, it's hard not to get a little concerned about pro-life ballot measures not succeeding. The only one that really concerned me was Kentucky. California and Vermont, I talked about this on the show a little while ago, but just to recap, the ballot measures in California and Vermont were a right for abortion. So that's not a pro-life ballot measure. The pro-lifers failed. The pro-choice ballot measure won. Those are pro-choice states. It's super pro-choice. Of course, that's going to happen there. We knew it was going to happen. Michigan is a pretty pro-choice state. There's a lot of pro-lifers there. So 55-45 was not that bad, especially, and I didn't mention, this is good, actually. This question came up. I didn't talk about this in the last episode. I think the Michigan no on Prop 3, which was to put a right to abortion. So there, once again, that's a pro-choice ballot measure, not a pro-life ballot measure that succeeded. So pro-lifers failed to defeat it. And I'm not as worried because, look, pro-lifers were outspent like 40-1. And when they're spent that much, it's just, It's very hard to overcome. All right. So the point is, it says no proposal three. No is in red circle. Three is in a red circle. It's all black, white, and red. And it says too confusing, too extreme. Okay. So the pro-lifers, so the prop three was a right to abortion in the Michigan Constitution. Yes on three said restore Roe, and it's purple and yellow and has pictures of women on it. The no on three campaign was no proposal three, and it's not aesthetically pleasing, red, black, and what's black, white, and red all over. The no on three sign, and it doesn't entice you. It's like, what is this? And all it says is too confusing, too extreme. When I see that sign, I'm confused. What is this about? I don't understand. It's like they were afraid to talk about abortion in the sign, so they thought, well, we're just going to tell people it's confusing and extreme. Don't vote for it. That's not a winning message. Show a picture of a third trimester baby and say, protect this child's right to live. And that's fair because Michigan's Prop 3 would allow abortion up till the moment before birth for any reason. And so the communication was really, really bad. You can have great arguments as pro-lifers, but if you're bad at communicating them, you're not going to win. So I am not worried, because I do think in a lot of these cases, so that was Michigan, 55-45 in spite of bad communication and being outspent heavily. Still not bad. Kentucky, that's a hard one. And that was close. It's like 52-48. But I think it's hard is that we have to accept as pro-lifers that most people do not want abortion completely outlawed. That we've known that for 50 years. Our route to success is incremental. And the best route to do that is through the state legislature, through a 15-week ban, a 6-week ban. And Georgia and Texas and Florida were able to get bans, incremental bans, and their governors survived re-election and won handily. So I just think that there are issues that don't do well on ballot referendums. It's hard to get people to vote for them, but you can get legislatures to pass them and people accept them as a part of the legislature. So I think that's the route that pro-lifers are going to have to go. We got to be careful of judges at the state level that try to create a right to abortion in state constitutions. That is a big thing to watch out for. Let's see here. Ah, Robert Boylan. Hi, Trent. I am here. I'm game to debate moving to Utah. He was in Ireland. He was in the land of Erie in Ireland. Is what I remember from Robert. And now he's going to Utah. Of course, being a Mormon apologist, I'd expect that. So with Blake Osler, perhaps one day. I got to keep keep my plate somewhat open. All right, we'll take a few more here as we round it out. Baby Trent and Laura's videos is my favorite Trent. On that note, I wish we had Brahms in Houston. Brahms is it's a kind of a Midwest burger place. I like their shakes. I don't like their food, but I like their shakes a lot and ice cream. I take my kids there. When my kids do jujitsu 3 times a week, they earn a shake. So I take them for that. And we had a video where I mentioned it. And I don't like putting my kids on the internet. And I think in general, I don't like when people do that, because kids can't really consent to that. And they're on the internet forever. So if you're going to put them on, you have to be absolutely certain it's not embarrassing. But otherwise, I don't like having my kids on the internet. I will have them on from time to time. I'd like to do a family free-for-all Friday soon, but I don't want them on a bunch. So when we need a kid in a skit for one of Laura's videos, I am the kid. And you know what? It works. It's fun. What's funny about that is there is a movie called Clifford with Martin Short. Let's see. All right, let's see. Make sure I'm getting the right. I'm pretty sure it's called Clifford. Yeah. Oh, dude, this is a hilarious movie. 1994, Martin Short and Charles Grodin. So Martin Short plays an annoying, obnoxious 10-year-old boy. And Charles Grodin is the straight man in the comedy. He is his uncle. And he is like, Martin Short nails an obnoxious 10-year-old perfectly. And the movie is so much better with this grown man pretending to be a 10-year-old than a 10-year-old doing it, because he just nails it perfectly. I think in some respects, it's helpful to have adults act like children, that it's even funnier, because most child actors are they're not super good. Get Uthman, Trent. Well, if Sheikh Uthman wants to do a debate on Islam, that would be, I would like to do that. Council Trent, who is the best upcoming apologist of 2022? up and coming apologists, man, I am excited to see a lot of people publishing and doing work. There are a lot of people whose names I want to get out there more. You know who's the best upcoming apologist? I don't know if I can call him upcoming or not. I want to say Joe Heschmeyer. I mean, Joe has been around for a long time. His Shameless Popery blog has been out there for like over a decade. But Joe did not have as much exposure. He just had his blog. Most people probably didn't hear about Joe. But we hired Joe a few months ago to work at Catholic Answers as a full-time apologist. And he's rocking it. His new podcast, Shameless Popery, is going to air in December. And so definitely go and check that out. Shameless Popery podcast. He already has the blog. But he's awesome. I've always enjoyed working with him. I've always enjoyed learning from him. So even though he's been around for a long time, now his platform has been raised a lot by going to work at Catholic Answers. So I hope a lot more people have him out to speak, listen to his podcast. He goes out and does debates or dialogues. I think that would be excellent to do. Oh gosh, there's so many more. I'm just going to take a few more here. Just a few more. Some fun and some regular ones. Any favorites for the World Cup? Yes, people who don't watch it. Those are my favorites. Because I can't stand it. Oh my goodness. Yeah, I don't know. How many of you guys here are soccer fans? If you're listening from overseas, maybe you are. I can't stand it. There was an article in National Review that said that soccer is un-American and unfair, and I agree. I don't like soccer. Now, here's my point. Here's why. I mean, you could sit for 2 hours and watch a game, and it ends 1-1 tie, 1-0. Lack of scoring. But it's not just the lack of scoring that's problematic for me. It is the fact that you could, and this is the point the NRO article makes, that they make. You could have it, and if you've watched the World Cup, maybe you've seen this. You could have a situation where Team A is dominating for 80% of the game, and it's 1-0, and they're just they're dominating, doing really well. And then 80% into the game, there's a foul on a guy right near the goal. And so the penalty is that they get a penalty kick. And professional soccer players make 78% of the penalty kicks. So you spent the whole game getting one goal, and then in an instant, you can get a penalty kick and tie the game. That would be like, imagine in basketball, if you fouled somebody, you could get a free throw shot that was worth 20 points. Like, it would be madness. It would be so unfair, and everyone would always be trying to get fouled, and it would just be, I don't like those elements of it. So no, I'm sure someone at the bottom would be like, why don't you like soccer? Because I was born in America. Okay. And guess what? We get to call our sport football, even though I know soccer is football in other countries. Interested in any debates with Jay Dyer? Well, we already had the debate on natural theology. I asked Jay if he wanted to debate the papacy, and he said, that's old hat. Let's do natural theology. I said, okay. I'd like to debate the papacy, I mean, or the historical foundations of it. I think that'd be interesting. But he didn't want to do that. So, I mean, you want to do a papacy debate in the future? We could talk about that for sure. Cathodox. Is annihilationism compatible with church teaching? This is controversial a little. Not controversial. So Cameron Bertuzzi mentioned this in his talks with Matt Frad a while ago and recently, and I'm hoping to sit down with Cameron soon to chat about a few things. But he said that, you know, he's always leaned towards the annihilationist view of hell, which is that the damned are not conscious of torment for eternity. They are destroyed. So the damned are destroyed in hell. They're not conscious of it. As opposed to the traditional view, what they would call eternal conscious torment. Can you be an annihilationist and be Catholic? I have addressed annihilationism before here on the channel, and I have made strong arguments against it. I dialogue Randall Rouser about it. I am not aware of a definitive teaching by the church condemning annihilationism. There is actually an anthology I have found online. Let's see. There's a Catholic anthology defending annihilationism. Oh, I will say, though, it's called A Catholic Reading Guide to Conditional Immortality by Robert Wilde, The Third Alternative to Hell and Universalism. So, and actually, it is, it was endorsed, I think, I want to say, I don't want to besmirch a priest, who's a solid priest that I know, but he actually endorsed the book. I just don't see it here. I want to make sure, pretty sure he endorsed it. I know he did, but I just want to, maybe I should scroll down and see if it's in here on the, on the pages. Ah, I can't find it. So the idea is that instead of suffering hell forever, you are God destroys you at the second judgment. I think the weight of tradition and scripture is heavily against annihilationism, heavily. But I'm, once again, I'm not aware of an official, a definitive church teaching on the matter. That you could read in a very strained way what the Catechism says to take the eternal punishment or eternal separation to mean that you're eternally annihilated, you're eternally cut off from God, you're eternally destroyed. That is the chief punishment of hell. You are separated from God for all eternity because you are destroyed. You can read them. I think it's a very strained reading of the texts. But it, at the very least, it may be something that requires the religious submission of mind and will. I'm not aware of any infallible teaching related to it, like from an ecumenical council. I'm aware of councils condemning things like universalism. The Council of Orange condemned the teachings of Origen, which were tied up with universalism. So universalism is condemned. Annihilationism, I think it's open, but it's a very bare minority view that doesn't have a lot going for it. I wouldn't put my marbles in that bag. But you know, I think it's an option you could pursue. I'm hoping that Cameron is not riding on that, you know, saying, oh, I can't be Catholic unless annihilationism is true. I think he's going to sort out a lot of his theology and his conversion. He still hasn't even been confirmed yet. But I think he might also endorse hopeful universalism, like Bishop Barron and von Balthasar's view that it is possible that no one dies in a state of mortal sin and everyone is saved. Maybe not probable, but it's possible and it's something to hope for. If that gets you through your day, fine, you're free to believe that. You just can't believe it's guaranteed that everybody is going to heaven. Oh no, so many questions. I think I have to probably wrap it up here and get ready for Zach to be here so we can start work on all this. Council Chant, my dream is to roll or spar with you. Is this realistic? Yes, it is realistic. I don't want to tell everybody what gym I go to here, because maybe you could contact me privately and I'll let you know. Everyone's going to show up there because it's easy. If you want to defeat me in jiu-jitsu, as long as you've gone to like a few classes, you probably can, because I'm still trying to learn as best I can, or boxing. But maybe contact me privately if you're here in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. We'll meet up. See what happens. Great. Well, thank you guys so much. Continue to pray for everything we're doing here. Coming up soon, I got a video talking about Matt Walsh and James White, actually. That'll be this week. Next week, I will not have episodes because I'm not going to be able to film a lot this week because we're going to tear all of this up. But I have some other episodes that are going to come later, things that are pre-recorded or recorded outside of the studio. And I'm hoping to debut the new studio probably at January 2nd. In the new year would be my idea. So thank you guys so much, and yeah, you all have a very blessed day. Thank you guys.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit trenthornpodcast.com.